Hello and welcome to Shame Spiral. I'm Ellie Kremendahl, a psychotherapist turned comedian, and this is the podcast where I low-key exploit my therapy skills to interview guests about all things shame. I was so excited, beyond excited truly, to spiral out this week with Ashley Lyle. Ashley is a TV writer, a showrunner, and the co-creator of what I feel confident in saying is my favorite show on television right now, which is Yellow Jackets. Yellow Jackets, bitch. I feel like the Venn diagram of people who love Yellow Jackets and listen to this podcast, it's a circle. I feel pretty confident that it's a circle. Ashley co-created Yellow Jackets with her husband and writing partner, Bart Nickerson. That is so cool. And she has a long career as a television writer. One show of hers that I had not watched before talking with her, but I have since, is called Dispatches from Elsewhere. It's so good. If you're looking for a new show to get into, check it out. Jason Segel is in it. It's weird. It's interesting. It's great. Something I want to mention about this episode is that Ashley's audio isn't the best. It's totally listenable. Huge gratitude to my audio engineer, Sarah, for fixing it the best she could. I don't know what happened. There are a couple moments where you're like, what is going on? You can still hear her, but it's just real wonky. But then it resolves itself. And just hang in there, okay? Because this is a great episode. I hate having to tolerate imperfection, including in audio, but I feel like it's passable. You can kind of start to accommodate to it the longer you listen. And this episode was too good not to share. Here's the thing about a shame spiral story for the week. I don't have one today for you guys. Honestly, I have been trying to record this intro for like hours and I keep not really being able to get through it. And I think this week I've just been honestly a mess, totally absorbed in the news and trying to educate myself as best I can, more than I already was, about what is happening with Israel and Palestine in Gaza right now. I like don't have a cute little shame story. I really have not been thinking much about myself other than that. I guess I felt more guilt, like spending time with my kids and being very, very aware of their safety and our privilege. And oh man, I'm just like really fucked up about all of this. And I'm sending you all love and hope for justice. And I'm sorry that this episode was late. I wouldn't say I felt shame about that. Again, just because I feel like I've had things more in perspective than usual this week. But I did feel guilty because I like to be reliable. And this is coming out, I don't know, probably like 12, 15 hours later than I would normally have it out. But I think we can all say, ultimately, that doesn't matter. And just know it doesn't mean I don't care. I care very much about you all and appreciate so much your listenership. And when I was trying really hard last night to kind of record this intro in any kind of coherent form and just failing again and again, I was like, I gotta call it. I have gotta call it and like try to just take care of myself. And I hope for you guys to do that for yourself too. I feel like I'm trying to, you know, take care of myself, but also not use taking care of myself as an excuse to look away or to stop engaging, because I feel like it's essential right now that I don't. And I think what I'm learning is that sometimes that means like something's got to give. So that meant that this podcast was late, and that is fine. That does not ultimately matter. But all right, I have to stop talking, but here it is now. You know, this episode is not really the tone of everything I just said. It was recorded a month or two ago. It was really fun. I love Ashley Lyle so much. And if you're in the need of, you know, some shame-based levity, it might be just what you're looking for. So let's get into it. Without further ado, let's start spiraling with Ashley Lyle.
Shame burning in my brain. always in a fright, and I've only myself to blame. Shame, wishing I could forget my name and crawl back up from where I came. I'm going down the spiral once again, the shame spiral.
I always start this conversation by asking folks how they feel right now in this moment, knowing that we're about to talk about shame. And I'm going to ask you a lot of questions about your shame.
I mean, I would say apprehensive, anxious, bit of a shame spiral happening in a very meta way. So I assume that's how most people feel, but maybe everybody else is just like, let's get into it. I feel great about this.
I think it really is a mix. Mm-hmm. So the shame spiral you're feeling, right, you're embroiled in the moment. Is it what we were just talking about offline? Like, because you're not a comedian or an actor or anything?
There's a lot of that. I manifold this morning. I also like debated where to do this. And I often do Zooms in bed. And then I was like, I can't do this in an unmade bed covered in pets, which is almost what happened. And then I finally was like, let's be honest, I didn't shower this morning. I have a friend, Alicia, whose advice is always, if you're going to be on a Zoom or anything with video, just put on lipstick and it's the same. Mm. And I choose to believe that, even though I'm pretty sure it's not true.
You look great. I would never have guessed that you hadn't showered.
I mean, dry shampoo, it's my best friend.
Me too. Mm-hmm. Dry shampoo is a miracle.
It really is.
Are you someone kind of prone to shame spiraling, anxiety spiraling?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm at like a 28, generally speaking. Although I will say a few years ago got on Lexapro, which is a real game changer when it comes to shame spiraling. I still do it, but I always describe it as, you know, there's a siren, a fire alarm going off in the background, and now I've got headphones on, or a little bit of earplugs, so you can still hear it, but it is not overwhelming in the same way. And added bonus, I no longer wake up at 5 a.m. just literally spiraling with my thoughts for no reason whatsoever. So I highly recommend it, or something like it, if you've been resistant and have the same problem.
Oh my God, I totally relate. I love that you shared that. I always feel like there's a moment in so many of these episodes that feel like an ad for SSRIs, because I also take Zoloft. For years I was on Lexapro, mm-hmm. now I'm on Zoloft after mm-hmm. I was pregnant, but it also was such a game changer mm-hmm. for me, because I still have anxiety for sure, but I love the metaphor you used. It's almost like, you know, when the smoke alarm is going off in your apartment or house mm-hmm. or something, and it's so loud that it's like the whole world boils down to just that smoke alarm.
Exactly.
Like, that's being unmedicated for me also. Mm-hmm. And then, on Zoloft, I'm kind of like, it's there. I can also go about my day fairly well.
It goes from being... The smoke alarm is going off in the room that you're in, to there's a car somewhere down the street whose alarm is going off, and not 24 hours a day.
Yeah. And is anxiety and shame, like with the kind of spiraling that you tend to do, like, are they very intertwined? Like, the things you feel shame about, are they the things that you anxiety spiral about?
100%.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure that I understand how they're different.
Interesting.
Anxiety and shame spiraling are to some extent one and the same. Because I think that things that don't feel sort of shame adjacent, I almost consider they're just more worries. Like, I'm worried about this thing at work, as opposed to anxiety, which is just like, you have fucked up, everything is wrong. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think for me, the connective tissue is like the difference between like, this is something to worry about, but if it's like, you fucked up, you did something wrong, and that's because you are inherently wrong.
Right.
And like, you're terrible. That's the shame for me, for sure. Yeah. When it makes that leap for you too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Accurate.
Yeah. It's the worst.
Fun.
It's so fun. Such a blast. So we're going to play the shame game.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you a couple questions, mm-hmm. or I'm going to propose a couple scenarios and want you to consider which would be more likely to give you a bigger shame spiral.
Okay. Oh, Lord.
And then we can kind of debrief.
Okay.
Okay. So here's scenario one. So let's say the strike has ended. Season 3 of Yellow Jackets is underway. It's almost over. Let's say it's the night before the finale of season 3 is airing.
Okay. It's all out there. Okay.
A lot there. Season has gone great. Everybody loves it. And you're texting with a good friend of yours and she's like, please just tell me what is going to happen in this finale. Like, I need to know, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, no. And she's like, come on. And you're like, okay. You know, because it's your friend, whatever, mm-hmm. you can text your friend. Mm-hmm. And you tell your friend, it's fine. You go to bed. That was really late at night. And when you wake up, you have like a zillion Twitter notifications, mm-hmm. and you see that you had meant to be texting her and you tweeted that text. and totally spoiled. Like, and it wasn't vague what you said. Right. Like, you gave her a lot of information. Everything everyone's been waiting for was in that text / tweet. And you've been asleep for hours. So it's unrecoverable. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously you wake up and you delete it, but the damage is absolutely done.
Okay.
I don't know what would happen to you. Like in any contractual way or anything if that happened, but you know. So there's that piece, and then there's also just the piece of like how you feel that you made that mistake.
Right.
So that's scenario one.
Okay.
Okay. Scenario two is that I know that you co-created Yellow Jackets with your husband, mm-hmm. Bart, correct? Right.
Yep.
So again, season three, you're midway season three, you're shooting it, you're on set. Something weird is going on in your marriage. Something happened. I don't know what it is, but it's caused a lot of conflict and you're working through it. You have kind of a tough morning before you go to work and you're like, it's fine. Like we're going to deal with this. We'll deal with it at home, keep things professional, whatever. But then something happens when you're on set where like you basically have like a pretty bad fight and you personally get like so triggered that we all have our sides that come out when we're like acutely triggered. So whatever mm-hmm. the worst is that you get interpersonally when you feel hurt is what happens. And it's witnessed by like the cast and crew and everybody. And it's rough. It's completely public. And then you just have to kind of go on with your day, but maybe it delays shooting a little bit, but it happened.
Okay.
So those are the two options.
Oh, okay. This is actually much easier than I thought it was going to be. The first scenario is absolutely without a doubt the worst scenario.
I figured, but just, yeah.
That one.
I probably should have dialed it down a little.
My heart rate is actually spiking right now, even just thinking about that. I think it's for a number of reasons. One is that social media is something that gives me anxiety anyway. I probably should not be on it. I have a tendency every once in a while. And, you know, we're encouraged. Bart and Jonathan, who's our co-showrunner, just are not on social media. They refuse to do it. Mm-hmm. They are so much the better for it. And so I can't help myself a little bit because I do like to see the fans' reactions to show the shows we're working on, and especially with Yellow Jackets, it's fun. But every time I tweet, I shame spiral a little bit. And I think also because it's, you know, as we were talking about, you know, just before we started recording, I am apparently what is deemed a geriatric millennial. Love that term. So, you know, I didn't grow up on Twitter or on Instagram or on TikTok. And so, you know, I think that I'm right at that border of understanding it enough, but not having it sort of in my blood. So it gives me some anxiety that, you know, what if I tweet the wrong thing or was that stupid? I mean, it's like, you know, the thing where you go to a party the night before and then you wake up the next morning going like, why did I say that? Or was that kind of dumb? Only it's to the entire world. So, so I think that that would definitely trigger a very significant shame spiral. In the second scenario, I guess what's interesting is that Bart is sort of like a little bit my shame shield. He's an incredibly sensitive person, and he is the person I will talk to about shame spiraling or like when I'm something's, you know, he'll kind of talk me through things. We also are not the kind of writing partnership where we get along or agree all the time. I know some writing teams where like one person pitches something, and the other person's like, that's great. Like, yes. And Bart and I are more like, if I say green, he says fucking purple. And then we have to debate it for three hours. So we're actually very, very, very good at arguing at this point and not bringing it to work. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's hard for me to even imagine a scenario where that would happen because even, you know, we have disagreed at work and we're just like, shut it down. We're going to shut it down because we're at work. And then we work through it later.
Yeah.
And then even if that were to happen, I feel like everybody on set knows us really well. And I think sees the relationship we have. So they might, they might be like, that was fucking weird. Like, what just happened there? But I think I'd kind of be like, well, yeah, you've never fought with your partner. Like, I salute you. Great. Good for you. But
yeah,
shit happens. So that one, I mean, it wouldn't be great. I wouldn't feel good about it, to be clear. But like, these are one is like, you know, a 2.5 earthquake. And the other one is like the big one, as far as I'm concerned, on an anxiety and shame spiral scale.
Yeah, that makes sense. What would the shame spiral for you look like in the event of scenario one? Like when you woke up and you saw what you had done, what would happen for you?
I would obsessively read every single Twitter response. I would immediately be like, Bart, what have I done? What do we do? Oh no. I would probably have to be on a series of phone calls. We'd have to call Jonathan, who is not online and probably would not have heard about it, and explain what I had done, which would be terrible because Jonathan is the best and he's a really good friend of ours. And I would feel like I had let everybody down. Probably would have to call our creative executives, who I also love and would have very much let down. Our entire marketing team. My God, this is, I don't even like thinking about this, to be honest.
I know, I'm so sorry.
This would not be a good situation. And then frankly, once I had dealt with whatever I had to do immediately, this would probably be like a take a Xanax, get in bed and pull the covers over my head scenario. Yeah.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just kind of crawl into a cave until you can begin to imagine coping.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know that is, it would be such a nightmare. But luckily it didn't happen and it's not going to now, especially. I hope I didn't create like a hypervigilance for you now around texting versus tweeting.
I already have a little bit of hypervigilance about that. Yeah, I mean, what would be more likely is that I don't think I would make that mistake. What I could see happening and has happened in the past, although never with like any kind of actual catastrophic results, is like, I'll get a couple drinks in me and then decide Twitter is a good idea. And it never is. That's not a good idea. And so I now have banned myself from getting on Twitter if I've had a couple of cocktails. I get very honest.
Oh, what has happened? Can you share, like, is there any sort of moment that comes to mind where that happened and it was a bad idea?
One thing occasionally I'll just try to respond to fans' questions and parts like, stop it. Like, what are you doing? Like, one person asked me which characters, what would their favorite Taylor Swift album be? And I am like, a very novice Swiftie. I listen to her music. I really like it. I'm not a Swiftie. I don't have a great handle on her entire move as it may be. And so I took a stab at it and they were like, wrong. And I was like, okay, I don't know, man. I tried. One that was probably a little more dangerous, but in retrospect, I don't regret it. Especially now in the moment that we're in, with the writer's strike I have to be clear, I really loved working with Showtime. I love working with our creative execs. They are wonderful. I think there is that aspect of this, and then there's the systemic aspect of the business portion of things. And I did tweet out explicitly what Bart and I were paid to make the pilot of this show. Because I do think that there is, you know, people were already kind of, there were rumblings of the strike, and I personally think that sharing information is the best way that we can have leverage and gain power. And so I'll say it again here. We were paid a producing fee of $40,000, which we split between the two of us, minus commissions, which is our managers and our agents and our lawyer. And that covered 8 months of work. So it wasn't great. And yeah, and I've never heard anything from, you know, the powers that be about that tweet. I feel fairly confident that somewhere someone is aware of it and wasn't thrilled that I tweeted that out. But I also think that it's important for, I think that there's a perception that, you know, people working in film and television make gazillions of dollars, and that is often far from true. And particularly for writers, development is a really long process. It is an underpaid process a lot of the time. And so, yeah, I did get a couple drinks in me and tweet that. And then the next morning I was like, oh, fuck, maybe I shouldn't have done that. But in retrospect, I don't have regret. So that one is sort of like a shame spiral that got stopped, which is rare for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you stand by it. Like, you didn't delete it or anything.
I did not delete it. No.
I feel like that is so important, that kind of like demystifying and openness and transparency. Mm-hmm. And you're right. Like, people do have this idea, like, people will just kind of hear like, oh, you got $40,000 for like one little thing that you wrote, which is also just so not accurate in terms of like, what do you think is happening to make this one little thing? Like, you're not like tweeting it off in 20 minutes.
Exactly. And to be clear, we were paid separately to write the pilot. This was specifically once they had greenlit the pilot, then, you know, you start the process of, you know, revising the pilot, casting the pilot. That's an incredibly intensive process with just long, long days in the casting office. You are doing pre-production, you're hiring your department heads, you're making all the decisions about production, from, you know, choosing your locations to choosing the picture cars that are going to be in the background. And then you're on set and you're shooting, and then you're in post. And post is, you know, really intensive on a pilot. We were there for probably 12 hours a day every day in a little tiny room in the basement of the Hollywood Production Center in Glendale, just editing this pilot. So that process took 8 months. And so that's what we were paid for that work.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Which is so, like, if you ever, or maybe you did, like, if you like tried to add up what you're like,
oh, the hourly,
like, hourly rate is,
it was like less, it was like waitress before tips money. Like,
yeah. That's so, I mean, that's so much work. In 8 months, it's like, how are you supposed to live on that for 8 months? And in LA, you guys live in LA.
We live in LA. I mean, you know, we had been working writers for a while beforehand, so we were able to weather that, luckily. But that's, you know, an example of the business side of things, putting the onus of risk to some extent on the creators, you know, and obviously they're risking the money that they spend on the pilot. But considering how much money they spend on the pilot, you'd think that they could pay a living wage to the people creating it.
You would think so. Mm-hmm. You would.
And to be clear, that is a really common, it's not just the people we were working with, that's industry-wide.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, that's not shocking to hear that, the information that you just gave. It's disturbingly normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I hope the strike ends soon to a good result.
I do too. I think we all do. I mean, I talk to a lot of writers, a lot of showrunners, and everyone wants it to be over. You know, there's nobody just digging in their heels emotionally and saying, like, fuck you guys forever. Everybody wants to get back to work. But I think at this point in particular, you know, we've been through this for this period of time. We have to, there's a lot of solidarity, I have to say. I've heard stories. Yeah. Bart and I had just moved to LA in 2007 during the last strike. So we had far less access to what other people were thinking. But I've heard stories that, you know, there was a little bit more division and people thinking, is this worth it? Is this not worth it? And the overwhelming solidarity, I think, is really different this time around and good to see. But everybody also just wants it to be over. Everybody wants it to be over.
I know. It's so rough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any particular, like, well, I mean, I feel like every writer does, but like, when you have shame come up around your writing or like writing process or just anything around that, I'm curious to know what that's like for you.
I am a really bad procrastinator when it comes to writing. Almost anything else, work-wise, I'm very on top of. But when it actually comes to sitting down at the computer and putting words on a page, I am the worst. And my big move is that I just hide in the bathroom and play games on my phone. And every once in a while, Bart will come and gently knock on the door and be like, "You okay?" And I'm like, "I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm thinking. I'm just thinking." But so that causes a lot of shame spirals. There have definitely, and Bart is not that way, luckily. So our process is often that he's sort of first draft guy, and I do much better when I have something in front of me to work with. And so that'll then, you know, at least get me going, and then I'll keep going and he'll jump ahead. And so that way, you know, we never want it to feel like one person is bearing more burden in terms of the creative work. But I am the worst. Like, I have friends who are like, "No, I'm a procrastinator." In fact, one time, I will not say what show this was for because I don't want to out myself that much. And also, I think it turned out okay. But we had a script due. It was due on a Friday. And on Wednesday, I was just trapped in like the most spiral of procrastination, where you get to the point where you're like, now it's too late. Now I have to brainstorm, like, do I slam my hand in the door so that I have an excuse for this? Like, what do I do? And so obviously my choice was to go to trivia night at the Bigfoot Lodge, because that's obviously what you do when you're panicking and procrastinating. And so I went and I did trivia and I didn't drink any alcohol. I just had a bunch of Red Bull. And I was like, that's it. I'm going to go home and I'm going to write this fucking script. And I somehow did it. Like, I mean, again, Bart was working on it too. But my friend Alicia of the Lipstick Advice, she was there and she was like, "Holy shit, you're really bad. Like, this is actually insane. You're an insane person." I was like, "This doesn't help. You're not helping me even remotely by pointing this out." And then, yeah, when she was like, "Oh no, you got it done. You got rewarded for your fucking insanity. Like, that worked out for you. And now you're just going to do it again." I was like, "Yep. Welcome to being me."
Totally. Yeah. Like, that's the problem with it. It does get positively reinforced.
Yep.
Every time you pull through. Mm-hmm. And I mean, are you someone who needs that dopamine rush of the last minute of the panic?
I think I need it.
Yeah.
Even when I try to be good and I'll sit down and diligently work, what'll end up happening is I will write and rewrite the first three pages for like a week and a half. Like, I will just get stuck there. Yes. And it takes the actual panic. And at some point, my internal clock does the math on, okay, you've got just enough time if you actually fucking do it now. And I really wish that wasn't the case. It is deeply unpleasant. And I also think that if I did not, no, you know what? If I was working alone, I'd do the same fucking thing. I would do it on every paper I had to write in college. Like, just every single paper I wrote was an all-nighter the night before. I have never once did I write a paper a week in advance. That would be madness for me.
Never. I really, Completely. I also have never, I have the exact same procrastination style. It's, I've never thought about it in terms of what you just said, that like when you have that limited amount of time left and you're like, I have to accomplish it now, there is no extra, mm-hmm. like there's no padding, then maybe it circumvents some of the anxiety that mm-hmm. stops you from moving forward.
Exactly.
You know, because that obsession with those three pages, it's like, you can get so like way too meta engaged mm-hmm. in this way that just blocks the process from moving forward. But if you don't have time for that shit, you got to keep going.
You just got to do it. That's the thing, is you can't, I mean, I think for me, there's a lot of, and I think this is deeply related to shame spiraling, but perfectionism and questioning if something's going to be good enough. And I think that the yeah. only way I can get past the internal monologue of, is this good enough, is it doesn't fucking matter anymore. You just have to get it done.
Oh my God. That's so real. I feel like that is such a part of my procrastination too, because do you have ADHD or ADD?
I have in the past several years had multiple friends tell me that I absolutely fucking do. I have not okay. been diagnosed.
Okay. I'm going to add to the group that is like low-key casually diagnosing you, which there's always like the SSRI moment on this mm-hmm. podcast, and there's the moment where I diagnose people with ADHD. but I didn't get diagnosed till I was 36. Mm-hmm. So I lived like that also my whole like educational and work life, thinking that I was just horrible for being such a procrastinator. And I was like, clearly hated myself and mm-hmm. didn't care about anything enough to change my behavior, whatever. I then got this diagnosis. I think a lot of it is that, like, it's just actually hard without the dopamine, and it's like nearly impossible to organize your thoughts, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I think there's that deeper layer you mentioned that's kind of about the perfectionism and like staring at the abyss and just being like, yeah. I just can't handle this unless there's some kind of structure in which I have to.
Exactly.
But yeah, you should get evaluated, because that can be a life changer.
Yes, I've been, it's on my list. It's funny. The one silver lining of this, speaking of things that are a little bit shameful, I had heard one of your recent episodes, you talked about not going to the dentist for 3 years. And I was like, LOL, 3 years. I have gone far longer than that.
You have.
Oh, yeah.
That makes me feel so much better.
Oh, yeah. One time I didn't go for like 6 years, and then you get to the point where you don't want to go because you're afraid of what's going to happen. So then you put it off even longer. And I finally went, and I got away with it. I had nothing wrong with my teeth. It made absolutely no sense. So once again, the universe just sort of rewarded my incredibly self-destructive bad behavior. In the past 4 years when we've been making yellow jackets, it's just been nonstop work. So that's been my perfect excuse to not take care of anything else in my life. Yeah. And now that we've been on strike, I've gone to the doctor, I've gone to the dentist, I've done the things. So, yeah. On my list is getting actually diagnosed with the ADHD I clearly suffer from.
It's so funny when that is like on a to-do list, because it's like so impossible to get yourself to do it if you have ADHD.
It's a total catch-22.
It really is. Yeah. The dentist thing, that really makes me feel so much better. I felt so bad. And I'll tell you, the only thing, speaking again of that like urgency that got me to go, I don't remember, I probably didn't say this in whatever episode you listened to, but that we might be able to get Cobra, whatever, but we're going to mm-hmm. lose our WGA insurance October 1st.
Oh, man.
So I know, but apparently if anyone listening, if this is relevant and you don't know, we just found out there's this like, through the entertainment fund, you mm-hmm. can get like a huge reduction in the Cobra. So hopefully it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
But I was like, now I have to do every doctor's appointment that I haven't done for the last 3 years, because mm-hmm. it's such good insurance, and whatever we can get through the marketplace, if that's what we have to do, is going to be like the worst thing ever.
You are not alone. I know a lot of people who are doing the exact same thing right now.
Really? I know. Ugh. And it's just, yeah, it just, I know. It sucks. It sucks. But it was the only thing. Like, I could not, this whole time we've had this great union insurance. Have I gone to the doctor or the dentist? No. Yeah. Not once.
Nope.
Not once.
Nope. I have not been a problem with the health of our health fund. I'll say that. I have not been drawing on the fund in a particularly large way. So, yeah.
Nope. Until this last month. It's so insane. Yeah. But whatever. So what do I want to ask you now? Okay. So I asked you to bring one story of something in your life that made you shame spiral. Do you have one in mind?
I do. And this was a little bit like, I recently did my friend Phil's podcast, which is very awesome. It's called Podcast Like It. And it started with Podcast Like It's 1999, and now they're doing 92. And he brought me on to talk about The Sopranos, which is my favorite show of all time. He's like, okay, pick two episodes. And I was like, how do I pick two episodes? That seems impossible. And now I have to pick Shame Spiral. I'm like, that's a thousand times harder. Are you kidding? There's just so many. There's only six seasons of The Soprano. I've been alive for 43 years. So this is a real challenge. But I thought about it and I decided to go back to what I think is my number one shame spiral. And I don't know if this will sound like a big deal. And you'll be like, wow, I am cringing so hard. What on earth? Or you're going to be like, that is so, like, what are you even still thinking about this for? And so with that preamble, it's actually my sixth birthday. So I can go all the way back to being 6 years old. And there's like a dual part of this. One is that there was this kid named Eric something, could not tell you, lost to time, but I do remember his name. And I think he had a little crush on me, and he was like the weird kid. And I was at six starting to figure out where I was going to fall on the social strata of elementary and ultimately middle school. And it was not very high. And I was sort of starting to understand this about myself. I was, you know, not one of like the cute girls. I was the weird nerdy girl with the thick glasses who, you know, loved to read. So I was not thrilled that Eric had a little crush on me. It felt like it was cementing where I was going to be on the social totem pole. And I remember he brought, you know, everyone else's parents had picked out some little Barbie present or something for me for my sixth birthday. And he had apparently specially picked out this pink satin jacket for me for my birthday. And the whole thing horrified me. I was horrified. And now, of course, in retrospect, I'm horrified by my reaction. I'm like, what an asshole. What a little fucking asshole you were. So I wasn't, you know, I don't even think I thanked him for the jacket because I just, you know, didn't want to deal with any of it. And this is actually weirdly not the biggest shame spiral of this day. The biggest shame spiral, the one that I still think about probably once a month, is that then somebody, because then I wanted to be cool, and somebody asked me what kind of soda we had to drink at the party. And I said, I'm sure it's whatever was on sale. My mom is very, you know, she can be very frugal. And my mom heard me, and she had, you know, planned this whole party, and she had made this coconut cake shaped like a bunny rabbit with a little Necco wafer nose. And it was the cutest thing. And she was so hurt by that. And I knew it. Like, I knew it in that moment as a 6 year old. And to this day, I feel fucking awful about that. Like, just what a little bitch I was. My God. And I understand as an adult, like, sort of why I did it and what was going on in my little 6 year old brain. But I just feel awful. I feel awful even now telling that story. So that is my ultimate shame spiral, because I'm still spiraling over that one. And I think I deserve to, because that one was bad. That was not a good thing.
Oh, my God. You're like, and you know what? I deserve every single year of punishment that I have put myself through.
All 37 years of it.
Ashley, oh, my God.
It's really bad. I mean, and you know, my mom to this day, she can be very frugal, and we tease her about it. And, you know, she's like, well, why would I not save, you know, the money if I can go over to Publix where they're having the sale? And I'm like, because it's 20 minutes out of your way, mom. Like, what are you doing? But, you know, she grew up, she was literally a coal miner's daughter. You know, they grew up with not much. And so, of course, she's that way. You know, he actually eventually was the foreman of the coal mine. So his job was to go down first and make sure it was safe for everyone else. Crazy part, too. This has nothing to do with shame and more to do with party Ukrainian genetics. But this man was the foreman of a coal mine, spent his entire life, you know, inhaling coal dust, smoked 2 packs of unfiltered Camels a day, loved beer and bologna, and lived to be 99 years old. Go figure.
You know what? That is the kind of statistic that really supports me in never quitting nicotine.
Like, I know, same.
I'm always like, see, it's fine.
I'm like, well, you know, it's mostly genetic. No, it's terrible. I've quit before, and I'm doing like, I quit for like a good 4 years, and then we started Yellow Jacket, and that was very stressful. And even my therapist was like, just fucking smoke. You need something. That's terrible medical advice.
Well, and now your therapist said it. That's the ultimate approval.
I know, right? Former therapist, I should say, which had nothing to do with that. Okay. I have a very conflicted relationship with therapy. I'm like, I don't like talking about my feelings. I like pretending they don't exist. So, I do have a new therapist because I realize that is not a great way to look at it. But yeah, now I'm on a kind of a patch / social smoking regiment, which I'm going to just let myself do for a little bit longer.
I understand, and I think that's fine because I want it to be fine. I'm curious about how that combination is working for you. I quit smoking, but I vape now. That was my replacement. And, and it's so bad because I've been pregnant twice. So through both of those pregnancies, I didn't use nicotine at all. So it's like, those were the moments where I could have easily just never gone back to nicotine. But then parenting is very stressful.
It's very stressful. Are you kidding? I don't have kids, but a couple of my really close friends have toddlers right now. And like my friend just went on a camping trip with some other people with young kids that she met in like a mom group or something. I don't know a lot about that world, but she was like, oh yeah, all the moms would just go off and smoke. Like the dads would just be like, oh, all the moms are smoking cigarettes again because it's stressful, man.
It's stressful. I think it's so interesting. Like there's something about, I don't know if you relate to like, I feel like being a teenager in the 90s as well, you know, like smoking, I just feel like my relationship to nicotine and smoking, I can see that it's different than people who are like even 10 years younger.
Yeah.
And it's just really hard to let go of. And we're almost the same age. I'm 42. You said you're like 43. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I also feel like my life now is very stable and healthy and responsible in a lot of ways. And I feel like nicotine is this like one thing I'm hanging on to. Like I get to like have something bad and bad for me. And it's almost like an existential, like raging against the void or something.
100%. It's like, it's a callback to that sort of teenage rebellion, I think. And yeah, it's hard to let go of it's not just the addiction, although that's obviously a part of it, but it becomes sort of an identifier of who you are. And I know that sounds ridiculous to anyone who doesn't smoke, but I feel like anyone who does is going to hear this and be like, yeah, I feel that.
Yes.
What is working for me, at least temporarily, or maybe this is going to sound very delusional, but I throw on the patch in the morning and then that way I don't smoke all day. And then if I go out and not smoking during the day is huge for me because for years I was like a committed smoker. I lived in New York. I would smoke in my fucking apartment, which now in retrospect is gross, but totally did it. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that I only smoke at night and, you know, it'll, usually I can keep it to one or two cigarettes. Every once in a while when I'm out with friends and we're like really going for it, like, oops, I just smoked half a pack of cigarettes somehow in one night. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, and there will be, you know, entire days and weeks where I don't. So I'm like, it could be worse.
It could be worse. I feel like that's harm reduction and mm-hmm. that's better than nothing. Do you ever do the trick where you tell yourself, like, if I was European, like, this would just be normal? Like, I wouldn't even feel shame about this.
100%. Oh, yeah. I'm like, I should just move to Paris so that I can just do this without feeling shame about it.
Totally. Oh, my God. It is such a callback to the limitless feeling of youth when you're like, I don't even mm-hmm. have to worry about dying.
Well, do you also pull the move that I do, which is I'll be like, well, fill in the blank will kill me first. I'm like, the stress is going to kill me first, or the whatever is going to kill me first. Or yeah. I'll be like, but I live in LA, so I'm breathing smog anyway. Like, none of this makes any sense. It's not a pure justification. But what it boils down to is, like, I don't want to fully quit smoking. And I think unless you really want it, it's going to be really hard. And so it's just, for me, the harm reduction right now is the best I can do.
I think that's fine. Yeah, I do that sometimes too. I'll tell myself other things will get me. Sometimes this is really dark, but sometimes I'm like, climate change is going to get us all.
Yeah.
So yeah. Like, why would I? And then I'm like, my grandmother lived till she was pretty old. She smoked like almost the whole time. I don't know. It's all fun. You know what? So like sometimes the associations that make me want to smoke are so funny. And what just made me think of that is, okay, I actually didn't say this yet. It's probably implicit because I asked you to come on this podcast, but obsessed with Yellow Jackets. Love it so much. One of my favorite shows ever.
Oh, well, thank you.
And of course. And the soundtrack is just, I feel personally a love letter to our generation, particularly women of our generation. And that whole fucking soundtrack makes me want to chain smoke in such a fun way. Like everything. Oh my God. All of it. PJ Harvey. Ugh, all of it.
Oh yeah. And that, it does the same thing for me, frankly, because, and not a coincidence, because, you know, we chose the songs that we were listening to when we were chain smoking teenagers. I mean, Bart has quit very successfully for probably, oh gosh, like 8 or 9 years now, maybe more. Wow. But he was also a smoker. So when we first met, we were both, you know, chain smokers together. And yeah, just some of those songs, just, yeah, that was me at 17 listening to Liz Phair and chain smoking and thinking it was very cool.
And you know what? You were very cool. You were very cool. Liz Phair, that Exile in Guyville is one of my top 10 albums, I think, of all time. Like, I think that that album is such a journey and the whole thing is fucking perfection.
It's so good. I actually got to very briefly meet her. She did a show at Largo when she published her book. And so a group of us went and it was sort of a combo of a reading. She read from the book and then she played a really short set. And because it's such a small venue, you could afterwards go up and get your book signed. And I think we may have slightly overwhelmed her with our fangirl and boyiness, but she was lovely and so sweet. And I think at this point we've actually only used Fucking Run in the show, but she was very cool about letting us do that, especially with a pilot, because people don't really know what the show is yet. Do they want to be associated mm-hmm. with it? And I guarantee you, there will be more Liz Phair at some point in the show.
I'm so glad to hear it. My husband is also, he's 43. And so I feel like when we watch your show, it's peppered with so many moments where like a song will drop and we just turn to each other and we're like, fuck yeah. Like, the song is so good. And many other things about the show are amazing. But this soundtrack is like, it's all these little treats just peppered through. It's so good. Okay, so we went on a real smoking tangent, but I let's go back for just a minute to your shame story, because we didn't fully debrief it. And you started by saying, like, you weren't sure if I would think it was, like, really small or, like, of course you should feel shame about this. And it's so wild, because I feel like so many of the biggest shame moments that we carry throughout our lives are objectively really small, but I can totally understand why that one has sat with you. There's so many layers to it, like, that I feel like I would imagine that it sort of contains this sense of, like, I'm a bad person who hurts people, like, that kind of thing, and, like, people who care about me. And it sounds like you're a sensitive, introspective person, and seeing the reaction of that little boy and your mom, like, that's, I think it says something about what a good person you are, because if you weren't a good person, you wouldn't have taken in either of those interpersonal moments so hard.
I appreciate that. That does make me feel a little bit better. And yeah, it honestly, both of those things just kind of make me want to cry when I think about them, because it's such an example to me. And I think, you know, part and parcel with shame spiraling is that you're caring so much what other people think and how you're perceived by the people around you. And I think the older you get, it's not that you stop caring. You know, when I was a kid, my mom would always be like, you're not going to care so much someday. And I was like, I can't wait to get there. That sounds nice. And I think that it's not that you care less about what people think. You just get more selective about which people you care about their opinions. And, you know, when you're a kid, you care about everybody. You care about, you know, people that you don't even like. You care about their opinions. And I think as you get older, you just focus in, and then it becomes, oh, like, did I embarrass myself around my colleagues who I respect, or did I say something stupid around my friends who I love? And so, you know, I think that at that point in time, I cared so much about what everybody thought of me, and it was at the expense of the people who I should be caring about. And I think that that's why it sticks with me.
That makes total sense. But it's like, of course, you know, it's like the people you feel safest with, like, especially when you're young like that, you're not aware of that dimensionality. Like, you'll throw them under the bus to feel a sense of worth, because you don't have to worry about if they love you or not. You do have to worry what your classmates think about your, like, Costco brand soda or whatever the fuck, you know, like, that feels more embarrassing.
Yeah. Yes. I think it was Cost Cutters, which is maybe a Jersey Shore deep cut from the mid-80s. But Cost Cutters was the move.
Cost cut. Are you from Jersey?
I am, yeah. Deeply.
I'm not. I feel like I said that in a way that made it sound like I'm from Jersey, but I'm not. Did you ever talk to your mom about that moment?
I'm pretty sure that I have. I also have a notoriously terrible memory. Like, my memory is very selective, and there are certain things, like these moments, that I will remember forever, and then other things just get past me. I can reread books and rewatch movies because I'm just like, ooh, I think I kind of remember what happens, but I'm not sure. I think we may have talked about it once, and she was like, oh, that, you're worried about that. Oh, that's not that big of a deal. But it's like, it's not even about her reaction anymore. It's the internalized shame. So,
yeah. Do you go really deep in it? Like, what does it say about you that you made that choice?
I think it's just, I don't think it defines me. I think, especially because I was so young and, you know, I know that I try my best not to do things like that anymore, but I think it's less what it says about me as a person and more just a profound regret. Like, they're just the things that you wish you could take back. And that's one. I think also because it was the first time, I think it must have been the first time I realized I could hurt my mom's feelings. I think as a kid, you don't realize that.
Yes.
Totally. And so again, just, you know, wanting to take it back is the overwhelming sensation.
That makes so much sense. And maybe like one of the first moments, or like the first moment where you recognize that power, like you could inflict harm, emotional harm on someone you love. And that's really deep. Like, I mean, and that's where it sounds like you were a pretty, pretty sensitive little 6 year old.
Oh, I was a weird little 6 year old. I had a, I don't know if this is obviously not related exactly, but maybe paints a broader picture of who I was at that age. But I had a standing list of, I was very into stuffed animals, loved stuffed animals, wanted to be a veterinarian before I realized that, you know, you basically had to go to med school and I'm a little squeamish and I didn't want to put animals to sleep. And I was like, okay, this is not the career path for me. But also I was very not into dolls. I was like, I'm a child. Why would I have a child? Like that did not track for me. And I did not think dolls were cute. I just did not like them. But stuffed animals, I had so many, I was obsessed. And then I had a list because I was aware that if I died, I would have a little child's coffin. So it's like, well, it's not going to be able to fit that many of my stuffed animals. So I had to have a list of the animals that needed to be buried with me. So that's the kind of kid I was. Oh, and it's shocking that I went on to make a show like Yellow Jacket.
I love her. I love this little child. Oh my God. That's so endearing. And was it hard for you? Like, was it a Sophie's choice of sorts to pick the
100%, animals? 100%. I mean, like, I felt really bad for the ones that weren't making the cut because they didn't get to spend eternity with me and they were going to feel bad about it. Like they were going to feel rejected. So, you know, I kept the list, like I didn't tell them. I definitely didn't tell them, but I, you know, I felt like they might know. And, you know, it was a bit of a rotating list. Like the two that were always on it were Mr. Candy, who is my pink teddy bear, and then Cupcake, who is my little Saint Bernard. But the rest was sort of a rotating list. Yeah.
What would get you to like, what would get someone higher up on the list or demoted?
I think it was just, I wanted to like spread the love so that, you know, it was more random. Like it just would depend on when I died, who got to be buried with me.
Yeah.
I let the universe decide a little bit. Yeah.
My favorite thing about what you said is that it's like, I didn't tell them, but you know, I feel like maybe they knew, like they could sense it.
My inanimate stuffed animals could definitely sense it. Yeah.
There's so much there about like not wanting to hurt, like not wanting to cause hurt. And yeah, it's really relatable. I understand. I think that is the cutest little weird child nugget ever. I love it so much. I love moments when my kids reveal themselves to be such weirdos because I totally like privilege weirdness, you know, like as like a good thing. And my kid a while ago was like, I love you so much. And I was like, I love you too. And then she was like, I love you so much that if you died, I would cut off your head and I would carry it around forever with me in a bag. And, and I was like, that's so sweet. Like, I love that. And it, but inside I was just like, you're such a goth queen. And I'm just like, so obsessed with how fucking weird you are.
I love that. I have a friend of mine has two daughters who are, I think they're like 8 and 11 now, but they are two little weirdos in the most delightful way. And one just wanted a murder party for her birthday. And she described in great detail, the cake had to have the outline of a body on it. And I was like, that is so good. So cool. Like that is, you're going to be the coolest person. And I love you.
I love it. I love it. I know I was careful to not like overreact how much I love it because then, you know, it's like, you don't want to be what your parents want you to be. Like, I don't like, exactly. I don't want her to like think I like her weirdness so much that she becomes Republican or something, you know, like that would be not good.
Oh man. Yeah. My mom still won't let me live it down that one time when I was very young, she was, you know, we were around a neighbor or something, I don't know. And she somehow came up, she's like, well, Ashley's going to take care of me when I'm old. You're going to take care of me, right? I said, oh, yes, I'm going to hire you the best nurse. That was my reaction.
That's amazing.
I meant it very sincerely, and she thought it was the funniest thing. And to this day, she's like, you're still going to hire me that great nurse? And I was like, oh, yeah, Mom, you're going to have the best of the best.
Oh, my God. I love that so much. That's so funny. Oh my God. That's so great. Okay, just a last couple things to ask you.
Sure.
All right. So if your shame as you experience it was embodied into some kind of like animal figure, creature, anything like that, what pops to your mind?
Ooh. I think it would be, I'm really debating between two, which is either a shark or a spider. And I think it's because those are the two things that I sharks just scare the crap out of me. Spiders, I have like a real phobia. Like if I see a spider, I lose my mind. One of my greatest fears is that I'll be driving on the freeway and a spider will come down from the visor and I'll just die and probably take down a bunch of people with me because like I will completely freak out and panic and just stop driving the car. So, and I think that they're both sort of relevant in that sharks feel like they swim in places you can't see, but you kind of know they're there and they're just looming, waiting to just eat you or take off an arm or a leg and in this incredibly violent, gory way. But I think spider, because I so just have this revulsion and it feels that revulsion to spiders feels a little bit like the internal chaos and tumultuousness of a shame spiral. So that's what I'm going with.
Yeah. It's so interesting to think about that in terms of a phobia, because it's like in the same way that you're repelled by the thing that you're afraid of, you're also drawn to it. It's like it takes up a lot of internal real estate because you're so scared of it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting, like in terms of thinking about that those metaphors as shame spirals.
Yeah.
That's spiders, that image of the spider dropping down and like imagining that you would not be able to prevent causing a horrific accident. That's so much anxiety all wrapped up into one horrific image.
I know. It'd be like straight up Final Destination 2 is what that would be.
Oh my God, that's so bad. Yeah, it would be Final Destination 2 if then your doors like automatically locked and like many spiders descended. That's so horrible. Oh my God. Okay. So was there anything that we talked about today or that I said, you said, anything that just popped to your mind in the conversation that in a meta way made you feel a little shame spirally or that you think will later if you're debriefing?
That's an interesting question. I feel like I do sometimes get a little bit anxious and shame spirally when I, even in a completely innocuous way, like share other people's stories. So even just talking about my friend's kid, which is an adorable story, and I know she won't care, and I did not name them or think, I may end up after the fact second guessing that. This whole thing is going to cause a little bit of a shame spiral because I do not enjoy the sound of my own voice. And then I'll get curious enough sometimes if I do a podcast that I'll listen to it for like 3 minutes and I'm like, I'm out. I can't do this. I can't do it. So this whole thing is a meta shame spiral, actually.
I understand. Yeah. yeah, I am always, someone told me recently after we finished recording that they were going to like looking forward to listening to it. And I was like, you listen to your, like, how do you tolerate that? Like, I have to force myself to listen because I have to. Like, but I hate, like, you could not pay me to listen to myself when I go on someone else's podcast.
Oh, no. I avoid it. I was recently on, I don't know how actors do it at all. I filled in. So they did an episode of Celebrity Family Feud with Yellow Jackets, which was really fun. And
really? Oh, fun.
Yeah. It was the teen cast versus the adult cast. And Kevin, yeah, it's actually delightful, although I can't believe
I'm going to watch it.
My mom just told me, I guess they're having to rerun everything because, you know, they don't have new content. And she was like, I just saw the rerun. I'm like, oh, God, stop watching it. But Yeah, Kevin Alves, who plays Travis, Team Travis on the show, he had a problem with his visa at the last minute, so I filled in. And there is no amount of money that you can pay me to watch that. Like, it will never happen. I absolutely refuse. I could not. I will die of shame. Like, if shame can kill you, that would be the result. So, yeah.
Because it's Celebrity Family Feud, death by that. That's
death by Celebrity Family Feud. It was even worse because it was last minute. And then Showtime was like, okay, we'll pay for a stylist because you're going to be on national television. Like, don't embarrass us. And the stylist, who I love, but she put me in this dress that was a little low cut. And I was like, I don't know. She's like, the girls look great. Put them on TV. I was like, okay, you're the boss. Like, this whole thing makes me nervous. Then I get there and the PAs are like, whoa, that this is like primetime television. We might have to cover you up. And I was like, oh God, okay, do it then. Put a sweater on me. I don't care. And then they're like, nah, it's fine. So then I'm just the whole time, like, kind of standing with my arms crossed because I'm like, and so it was a nightmare. It was an actual nightmare. Talk about shame spiraling.
No, seriously. And that, I feel like that is such a teenage scented shame. Like, I have to like cover my boobs because I feel inappropriate.
I'm being inappropriate in front of Steve Harvey and the rest of America. Great.
Stop.
Love it.
I can't deal with that. Oh my God.
If you want to watch me look extremely uncomfortable on national television, there's a way to do it.
Now I absolutely have to. And I feel like I want to tell you after I bet it's not as bad as you. I bet you feel like it was so clear what you were feeling and doing, but I bet it's not.
It's probably fine, but just as a shamey situation, I want you to imagine that you're on television, which is a deeply weird thing. You are a person who doesn't even like having your picture taken. You've been told that your boobs are too much, are showing too much, and also you're on stage with the world's most beautiful women. It's just you and the world's most beautiful women. I was just like, oh, I'm going to wake up at some point because this is an actual nightmare.
Mm-hmm. I do understand that. Yeah. Oh boy. Yeah, I get that. That's hard. That's really hard. Now I'm like just deep in thinking. I'm imagining that, and I'm thinking about. I run this like queer comedy show in Brooklyn, and we had Amanda Seyfried come on and do like a bit with us because we did a fundraiser, and like I know how beautiful she is. I know her. Like, I know her as a person. So it's, I've desensitized myself to it at this point. But I like chose to wear overalls like that night. And there was just one point where I was like, right before we were backstage, and I was just like looking at her and looking at myself in my overalls. And I had just like such a seventh grade moment where I was like, why have you done this to yourself? Like, why have you, this is gruesome. This is so bad.
Yeah, I've had to mostly desensitize because. Yeah, I chose a profession where I am around extremely just top tier beautiful people constantly and then have to be on stage with them and have my pictures taken with them. And I'm like, you know what? I made this bed. Now I have to lie in it. And I'm mostly desensitized. Mm-hmm. But then you throw in the camera and the boobs and it just became overwhelming.
Yeah, 100%. That's too much. That's too much piled on an already tall order. So, all right, I don't want to take more of your time, but how do you feel right now?
I this was so much fun. So it's sort of an interesting contrast of sensations because I do think that my heart rate is still up a little bit from talking about all of these things, but I also had a really good time. And I think also with age has come just a greater sense of the comedy of shame and how we all feel it. And some of these things, while truly horror inspiring and shameful, are also deeply funny. So, I feel good. I also feel glad that I have therapy in 10 minutes.
Oh my God. I hope you didn't have much else to talk about today on the docket. Right.
I'm like, oh, I might have to shame. I don't think I've talked about these things with her. So maybe today is the day. Maybe we can dig in a little bit deeper.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Shame Spiral. You can follow the pod at Pod Shame Spiral on Twitter and Instagram. And you can find the podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and all the usual places. This episode was edited by myself and Sarah Gabrielli, and original music was by Shadwick Wild. Please keep listening and rate and review if you're feeling generous. I have so many exciting guests lined up for our season. Thank you again for joining us, and spiral on, but not too much, okay?